Shit. He'd forgotten humans traveled with baggage as if they were moving somewhere.
We lost most of it on our trip out of the mountains. My husband,
Marion said with charming annoyance,
insisted we ford a rushing stream. I'm lucky he even bothered to help me out, since he certainly didn't go after our supplies.
A low chuckle from Nick. I suspect he was more focused on saving you than on the packs. Marion rolled her eyes, patting Lorkin's knee. He nearly cringed at every touch. Even with his lovers, outside the bed itself, he didn't like casual, careless contact. Some found that intolerable. Some thought they could break him into a decent male who just wanted a home and a good female to work beside him. Not one of them had succeeded.
First held in his hand something like a spear, but the hands of the other were open, with the palms towards him. But I don't know that any of these attempts has helped me much. At all events, what Ransom saw at that moment was the real meaning of gender. Everyone must sometimes have wondered why, in nearly all tongues, certain inanimate objects are masculine and others feminine. What is masculine about a mountain, or feminine about certain trees? Ransom has cured me of believing that this is a purely morphological phenomenon, depending on the form of the word. Still less is gender an imaginative extension of sex. Our ancestors did not make mountains masculine because they projected male characteristics into them. The real process is the reverse. Gender is a reality and a more fundamental reality than sex. Sex is, in fact, merely the adaptation to organic life of a fundamental polarity which divides all created beings. Female sex is simply one of the things that have feminine gender. There are many others. And masculine and feminine meet us on planes of reality where male and female would be simply meaningless. Masculine is not attenuated male, nor feminine attenuated female. On the contrary, the male and female of organic creatures are rather faint and blurred reflections of masculine and feminine. Their reproductive functions, their differences in strength and size, partly exhibit, but partly also confuse and misrepresent the real polarity. All this Ransom saw, as it were, with his own eyes. The two white creatures were sexless. But he of Malacandra was masculine, not male. She of Perelandra was feminine, not female. Malacandra seemed to him to have the look of one standing armed at the ramparts of his own remote archaic world in ceaseless vigilance, his eyes ever roaming the earthward horizon whence his danger came long ago. A sailor's look, Ransom once said to me, you know, eyes that are impregnated with distance. But the eyes of Perelandra opened, as it were, inward, as if they were the curtained gateway to a world of waves and murmurings and wandering airs, of life that rocked in winds and splashed on mossy stones and descended as the dew and arose sunward in thin-spun delicacy of mist. On Mars the very forests are of stone. In Venus the lands swim. For now he thought of them no more as Malacandra and Perelandra. He called them by their Tellurian names. With deep wonder he thought to himself, "My eyes have seen Mars and Venus. I have seen Ares and Aphrodite." He asked them how they were known to the old poets of Tellus. When and from whom had the children of Adam learned that Ares was a man of war and that Aphrodite rose from the sea foam? Earth has been besieged, an enemy-occupied territory since before history began. The gods have had no commerce there. How then do we know of them? It comes, they told him, a long way round and through many stages. There is an environment of minds as well as of space. The universe is one, a spider's web wherein each mind lives along every line, a vast whispering gallery where, save for the direct action of Maleldil, though no news travels unchanged, yet no secret can be rigorously kept. In the mind of the fallen Archon under whom our planet groans, the memory of deep heaven and the gods with whom he once consorted is still alive. Nay, in the very matter of our world, the traces of the celestial commonwealth are not quite lost. Memory passes through the womb and hovers in the air. The muse is a real thing. A faint breath, as Virgil says, reaches even the late generations. Our mythology is based on a solider reality than we dream. But it is also at an almost infinite distance from that base. And when they told him this, Ransom at last understood why mythology was what it was. Gleams of celestial strength and beauty falling on a jungle of filth and imbecility. His cheeks burned on behalf of our race when he looked on the true Mars and Venus and remembered the follies that have been talked of them on Earth. Then a doubt struck him. "But do I see you as you really are?" he asked. "Only Maleldil sees any creature as it really is," said Mars. "How do you see one another?" asked Ransom. "There are no holding places in your mind for an answer to that." "Am I then seeing only an appearance? Is it not real at all?" "You see only an appearance, small one. You have never seen more than an appearance of anything, not of Arbol, nor of a stone, nor of your own body. This appearance is as true as what you see of those."
"But there were those other appearances."
"No. There was only the failure of appearance." "I don't understand," said Ransom. "Were all those other things, the wheels and the eyes, more real than this or less?"
"There is no meaning in your question," said Mars. "You can see a stone, if it is a fit distance from you, and if you and it are moving at speeds not too different. But if one throws the stone at your eye, what then is the appearance?"
"I should feel pain, and perhaps see splintered light," said Ransom. "But I don't know that I should call that an appearance of the stone."
"Yet it would be the true operation of the stone. And there is your question answered. We are now at the right distance from you."
"And were you nearer in what I first saw?"
"I do not mean that kind of distance."
"And then," said Ransom, still pondering, "there is what I had thought was your wonted appearance, the very faint light, O Yarsa, as I used to see it in your own world. What of that?"
"That is enough appearance for us to speak to you by. No more was needed between us. No more is needed now. It is to honour the king that we would now appear more. That light is the overflow or echo into the world of your senses, of vehicles made for appearance to one another and to the greater Eldila."
At this moment, Ransom suddenly noticed an increasing disturbance of sound behind his back, of uncoordinated sound, husky and pattering noises which broke in on the mountain silence and the crystal voices of the gods with a delicious note of warm animality. He glanced round. Romping, prancing, fluttering, gliding, crawling, waddling, with every kind of movement, in every kind of shape and colour and size, a whole zoo of beasts and birds was pouring into a flowery valley through the passes between the peaks at his back. They came mostly in their pairs, male and female together, fawning upon one another, climbing over one another, diving under one another's bellies, perching upon one another's backs. Flaming plumage, gilded beaks, glossy flanks, liquid eyes, great red caverns of whinnying or of bleating mouths, and thickets of switching tails surrounded him on every side. "A regular Noah's Ark," thought Ransom, and then, with sudden seriousness, "but there will be no ark needed in this world." The song of four singing beasts rose in almost deafening triumph above the restless multitude. The great Eldil of Perelandra kept back the creatures to the hither side of the pool, leaving the opposite side of the valley empty, except for the coffin-like object. Ransom was not clear whether Venus spoke to the beasts, or even whether they were conscious of her presence. Her connection with them was perhaps of some subtler kind, quite different from the relations he had observed between them and the Green Lady. Both the Eldila were now on the same side of the pool with Ransom. He and they and all the beasts were facing in the same direction. The thing began to arrange itself. First, on the very brink of the pool were the Eldila, standing. Between them and a little back was Ransom, still sitting among the lilies. Behind him the four singing beasts, sitting up on their haunches like fire dogs and proclaiming joy to all ears. Behind these again the other animals. The sense of ceremony deepened. The expectation became intense. In our foolish human fashion, he asked a question merely for the purpose of breaking it. "How can they climb to here and go down again and yet be off this island before nightfall?" Nobody answered him. He did not need an answer, for somehow he knew perfectly well that this island had never been forbidden them, and that one purpose in forbidding the other had been to lead them to this, their destined throne. Instead of answering, the god said, "Be still." Ransom's eyes had grown so used to the tinted softness of Perelandrian daylight,
and specially since his journey in the dark guts of the mountain, that he had quite ceased to notice its difference from the daylight of our own world. It was, therefore, with a shock of double amazement that he now suddenly saw the peaks on the far side of the valley showing really dark against what seemed a terrestrial dawn. A moment later, sharp, well-defined shadows, long like the shadows at early morning, were streaming back from every beast and every unevenness of the ground, and each lily had its light and its dark side. Up and up came the light from the mountain slope. It filled the whole valley. The shadows disappeared again. All was in pure daylight that seemed to come from nowhere in particular. He knew ever afterwards what is meant by a light resting on or overshadowing a holy thing, but not emanating from it. For as the light reached its perfection and settled itself, as it were, like a lord upon his throne or like wine in a bowl, and filled the whole flowery cup of the mountain top, every cranny with its purity, the holy thing, paradise itself in its two persons, paradise walking hand in hand, its two bodies shining in the light like emeralds, yet not themselves too bright to look at, came in sight in the cleft between two peaks, and stood a moment with its male right hand lifted in regal and pontifical benediction, and then walked down and stood on the far side of the water. And the gods kneeled and bowed their huge bodies before the small forms of that young king and queen.
Chapter 17, The Last Chapter. There was great silence on the mountain top, and Ransom also had fallen down before the human pair. When at last he raised his eyes from the four blessed feet, he found himself involuntarily speaking, though his voice was broken and his eyes dimmed. "Do not move away, do not raise me up," he said. "I have never before seen a man or a woman. I have lived all my life among shadows and broken images. O my father and my mother, my lord and my lady, do not move, do not answer me yet. My own father and mother I have never seen. Take me for your son. We have been alone in my world for a great time." The eyes of the queen looked upon him with love and recognition, but it was not of the queen that he thought most. It was hard to think of anything but the king. And how shall I who have not seen him, tell you what he was like? It was hard even for Ransom to tell me of the king's face, but we dare not withhold the truth. It was that face which no man can say he does not know. You might ask how it was possible to look upon it and not to commit idolatry, not to mistake it for that of which it was the likeness. For the resemblance was, in its own fashion, infinite, so that almost you could wonder at finding no sorrows in his brow and no wounds in his hands and feet. Yet there was no danger of mistaking, not one moment of confusion, no least sally of the will towards forbidden reverence. Where likeness was greatest, mistake was least possible. Perhaps this is always so. A clever waxwork can be made so like a man that for a moment it deceives us. The great portrait, which is far more deeply like him, does not. Plaster images of the Holy One may before now have drawn to themselves the adoration they were meant to arouse for the reality. But here, where his live image, like him within and without, made by his own bare hands out of the depth of divine artistry, his masterpiece of self-portraiture coming forth from his workshop to delight all worlds, walk and spoke before Ransom's eyes, it could never be taken for more than an image. Nay, the very beauty of it lay in the certainty that it was a copy, like and not the same, an echo, a rhyme, an exquisite reverberation of the uncreated music prolonged in a created medium. Ransom was lost for a while in the wonder of these things, so that when he came to himself he found that Perelandra was speaking, and what he heard seemed to be the end of a long oration. "The floating lands and the firm lands," she was saying, "the air and the curtains at the gates of deep heaven, the seas and the holy mountain, the rivers above and the rivers of underland, the fire, the fish, the birds, the beast, and the others of the waves whom yet you know not, all these Maleldil puts into your hand from this day forth as far as you live in time and farther. My word henceforth is nothing. Your word is law unchangeable and the very daughter of the voice. In all that circle which this world runs about Arbol, you are Oyarsa. Enjoy it well. Give names to all creatures, guide all natures to perfection. Strengthen the feebler, lighten the darker, love all.
Hail and be glad, O man and woman, O Yarsa Perelendri, the Adam, the Crown, Tor and Tinidril, Baru and Barua, Ask and Embla, Yatsor and Yatsora, dear to Maleldil, blessed be he. When the king spoke in answer, Ransom looked up at him again. He saw that the human pair were now seated on a low bank that rose near the margin of the pool. So great was the light that they cast clear reflections in the water, as they might have done in our own world. "We give you thanks, fair foster-mother," said the king, "and specially for this world in which you have laboured for long ages as Maleldil's very hand, that all might be ready for us when we woke. We have not known you till today. We have often wondered whose hand it was that we saw in the long waves and the bright islands, and whose breath delighted us in the wind at morning. For though we were young then, we saw dimly that to say it is Maleldil was true, but not all the truth. This world we receive. Our joy is the greater because we take it by your gift as well as by his. But what does he put into your mind to do henceforward?" "It lies in your bidding, Tor Oyarsa," said Perelandra, "whether I now converse in deep heaven only, or also in that part of deep heaven which is to you a world." "It is very much our will," said the king, "that you remain with us, both for the love we bear you, and also that you may strengthen us with counsel, and even with your operations. Not till we have gone many times about Arbol shall we grow up to the full management of the dominion which Maleldil puts into our hands. Nor are we yet ripe to steer the world through heaven, nor to make rain and fair weather upon us. If it seems good to you, remain." "I am content," said Perelandra. While this dialogue proceeded, it was a wonder that the contrast between the Adam and the Eldils was not a discord. On the one side, the crystal, bloodless voice and the immutable expression of the snow-white face, on the other, the blood coursing in the veins, the feeling trembling on the lips and sparkling in the eyes, the might of the man's shoulders, the wonder of the woman's breasts, a splendor of virility and richness of womanhood unknown on earth, a living torrent of perfect animality. Yet when these met, the one did not seem rank, nor the other spectral. "Animal rationnel."
Claws going low while its teeth went right for his throat. Lorcan drew his hunting knife, so fast it was only the glint of gray light on steel. Beast and fey male went down, right into the muddy water. Elide hurtled for him, a wordless scream breaking from her. Not a normal mountain lion. Not even close. Not with the way it knew Lorcan's every move as they rolled through the water, as they dodged and swiped and lunged. Her voice cracked.
"I wish he'd been able to take the oath. But Terrasen will look to him now, and the lines must not break."
Elide nodded, tears sliding down her blood-splattered face.
"And tell Rowan."
Aelin's soul splintered as she saw the iron box the escorts now carried between them. An ancient iron coffin, big enough for one person, crafted for her.
"And tell Rowan," Aelin said, fighting her own sob, "that I'm sorry I lied. But tell him it was all borrowed time anyway. Even before today, I knew it was all just borrowed time. But I still wish we'd had more of it."
She fought past her trembling mouth.
"Tell him he has to fight. He must save Terrasen. And remember the vows he made to me. And tell him thank you for walking that dark path with me back to the light."
They opened the lid of the box, pulling out long, heavy chains within. One of the escorts handed Maeve an ornate iron mask. She examined it in her hands. The mask, the chains, the box. They had been crafted long before now. Centuries ago. Forged to contain and break Mala's scion. Aelin glanced at Lorcan, whose dark eyes were fixed on her own. And gratitude shone there. For sparing the young woman he'd given his heart to, whether he knew it or not. Elide begged Maeve one last time.
Don't do this.
Blood spurting, magic clashing, shield against shield. Then the wolf attacked. A massive white wolf, sprinting out of nowhere, wild with rage and all of it focused on Lorcan. Lorcan broke from the lion, blood streaming down his arm, his leg, panting. But the wolf had vanished into nothing. Where was it? Where was it? It appeared out of thin air, as if it had stepped through an invisible bridge 10 feet from Lorcan. Not an attack. An execution. Elide cleared a gap between two mounds of land, icy grass slicing into her palms, something crunching in her leg. The wolf leaped for Lorcan's vulnerable back, eyes glazed with bloodlust, teeth shining. Elide surged up the little hill, time spinning out beneath her.
No, 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 no!
Vicious white fangs neared Lorcan's spine. Lorcan heard her then, heard the shuddering sob as she threw herself into him. His dark eyes flared in what looked like terror as she slammed into his unprotected back. As he noted the death blow not coming from the lion at his front, but the wolf whose jaws closed around her arm instead of Lorcan's neck. She could have sworn the wolf's eyes flared in horror as it tried to pull back the physical blow, as a dark, hard shield slammed into her, stealing her breath with its unflinching solidity. Blood and pain and bone and grass and bellowing fury. The world tilted as she and Lorcan went down, her body thrown over his, the wolf's jaws wrenching out of her arm. She curled over Lorcan, waiting for the wolf and mountain lion to end it, to take her neck in their jaws and crunch down. No attack came. Silence cleaved the world. Lorcan flipped her over, his breathing ragged, his face bloody and pale as he took in her face. Aelin knew it would do her no good. So she said to Elide,
I'm glad we met. I'm proud to know you. And I think your mother would have been proud of you too, Elide.
Maeve lowered the mask and drawled to Aelin,
Rumor claims you will bow to no one, heir of fire.
That serpentine smile.
Well, now you will bow to me.
She pointed to the sand. Aelin obeyed. Her knees barked as she dropped to the ground.
Lower.
Aelin slid her body until her brow was in the sand. She did not let herself feel it, let her soul feel it.
Good.
Elide was sobbing, wordlessly begging.
Take off your shirt.
Aelin hesitated, realizing where this was going. Why Cairn's belt carried a whip.
Take off your shirt.
Aelin tugged her shirt out of her pants and slung it over her head, tossing it in the sand beside her. Then she removed the flexible cloth around her breasts.
Varric, Hiran.
Two fey males came forward. Aelin didn't fight, as they each gripped her by an arm and hauled her up, spread her arms wide. The sea air kissed her breasts, her navel.
10 lashes, Cairn. Let Her Majesty have a taste of what to expect when we reach our destination, if she does not cooperate.
It would be my pleasure, lady.
Aelin held Cairn's vicious gaze, willing ice into her veins as he thought her arm.
Elide, Elide, Elide!
She couldn't draw breath. Couldn't see around the sensation that her arm was mere shredded flesh and splintered bone. Lorcan grabbed her face before she could look, and snapped,
Why did you do that? Why?
He didn't wait for an answer. He lifted his head, his snarl so vicious it echoed in her bones, made the pain in her arm surge violently enough that she whimpered.
He growled to the lion and the wolf, his shield a swirling obsidian wind around them.
You're dead. You're both dead.
Elide shifted her head enough to see the white wolf staring at them. At Lorcan. See the wolf change in a flash of light into the most beautiful man she'd ever beheld. His golden-brown face tightened as he took in her arm. Her arm. Her arm.
Lorcan, we were ordered,
said an unfamiliar, gentle male voice, from where the lion, too, had transformed into a fey male.
Damn your orders to hell, you stupid bastard!
The wolf warrior hissed, chest heaving.
We can't fight against the command much longer, Lorcan. Put the shield down,
the calmer one said.
I can heal the girl. Let her get away. I'll kill you both,
Lorcan swore.
I'll kill you.
Elide looked at her arm. There was a piece missing from her forearm. There was blood gushing into the burnt remnants of grass, white bone jutting out. Maybe she started screaming, or sobbing, or silently shaking.
Don't look,
Lorcan snapped, squeezing her face again to draw her eyes to his own. His face was lined with such wrath she barely recognized it, but he made no move against the males, pumped free his whip. As he raked his eyes over her body and smiled, a canvas for him to paint with blood and pain. Maeve said, the mask dangling from her fingers.
Why don't you count for us, Aelin?
Aelin kept her mouth shut.
Count, or we'll begin again with each stroke you miss. You decide how long this goes on for. Unless you'd rather Elide Lorcan receive these strokes.
No. Never. Never anyone else but her. Never.
But as Cairn walked slowly, savoring each step, as he let that whip drag along the ground, her body betrayed her, began shaking. She knew the pain. Knew what it'd feel like, what it'd sound like. Her dreams were still full of it. No doubt why Maeve had picked a whipping, why she'd done it to Rowan and Doranell. Cairn halted. She felt him studying the tattoo on her back. Rowan's loving words written there in the old language. Cairn snorted. Then she felt him revel in how he'd destroy that tattoo.
Begin, Maeve said.
Cairn's breath sucked in. And even bracing herself, even clamping down hard, there was nothing to prepare for the crack, the sting, the pain. She did not let herself cry out, only hissed through her teeth. A whip wielded by an overseer at Endovir was one thing. One wielded by a full-blooded fey male. Blood slid down the back of her pants, her split skin screaming. But she knew how to pace herself, how to yield to the... His power was drained. He'd nearly wiped it out shielding against Aelin's flame, and whoever had borne that other magic on the field. This shield. This was all Lorcan had left. And if he lowered it so they could heal her, they'd kill him. He had warned them of the attack, and they'd still kill him. Aelin. Where was Aelin? The world was blackening at the edges, her body begging to submit, rather than endure the pain that reordered everything in her life. Lorcan tensed as if sensing the oblivion that threatened.
You heal her,
he said to the gentle-eyed male.
And then we continue.
No, she got out. Not for this. Not for her. Lorcan's onyx eyes were unreadable as he scanned her face. And then he said quietly,
I wanted to go to Paranth with you.
Lorcan dropped the shield. It was not a hard choice, and it did not frighten him. Not nearly as much as the fatal wound in her arm did. Fenris had hit an artery. She'd bleed out in minutes. Lorcan had been born from and gifted with darkness. Returning to it was not a difficult task. But letting that glimmering, lovely light before him die out, in his ancient, bitter bones, he could not accept it. She had been forgotten by everyone and everything, and still she had hoped, and still she had been kind to him, and still she had offered him a glimpse of peace in the time he'd known her. She had offered him a home. He knew Fenris wouldn't be able to fight Maeve's kill order. Nugek then took the money pouch from Lorcan's free hand without so much as a thank you. The dark-haired beauty leaned forward to murmur to Marion,
"Don't look them in the eye, and don't talk back."
Marion nodded, chin dipping as she focused on the ground. Against him, he could feel her racing heart, wild, despite the calm submission written over every line of her body.
"And you?"
the beauty hissed at him, as the soldiers searched their wares and took what they wanted.
"Molly says if you get into a fight, you're gone, and we're not bailing you out of prison. So let them talk and laugh, but don't interfere."
Lorcan debated saying he could slaughter this entire garrison if he pleased, but nodded. After 5 minutes, another order was shouted. Molly handed over Lorcan's money and her own to pay the toll, plus more for expedited passage. Then they were all back in the wagon again, none of them daring to see what had been pilfered. Marion was shaking slightly against where he kept her tucked into his side. But her face was blank, bored. The guards hadn't so much as questioned them, hadn't asked after a woman with a limp. The acanthus roared beneath them as they crossed the bridge, wagon wheels clattering on ancient stones. Marion kept shaking. Lorcan studied her face again, the hint of red along her high cheekbones, her tight mouth. Not shaking from fear, he realized, as he caught a whiff of her scent. A slight tang of it, perhaps, but mostly something red-hot, something wild and raging and anger. It was boiling rage that made her shake. At the inspection, at the leering of the guards. Pain. How to take it.
"What number was that, Aelin?"
She would not. She would never account for that rutting bitch.
"Start over, Cairn," Maeve said.
A breathy laugh. Then the crack and the pain, and Aelin arched, the tendons in her neck near snapping as she panted through clenched teeth. The males holding her gripped her firm enough to bruise. Maeve and Cairn waited. Aelin refused to say the word. To start the count. She'd die before she did it.
"Oh, gods, oh, gods,"
Elide sobbed.
"Start over,"
Maeve merely ordered over the girl. So Cairn did. Again. 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 They started over 9 times before Aelin finally screamed. The blow had been right atop one another, tearing skin down to the bone. Again. 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 Cairn was panting. Aelin refused to speak.
"Start over," Maeve repeated.
"Majesty," murmured one of the males holding her. "It might be prudent to postpone until later."
"There's still plenty of skin," Cairn snapped. But the male said,
"Others are approaching. Still far off, but approaching."
Rowan. Aelin whimpered then. Time. She had needed time. Maeve made a small noise of distaste. We'll continue later. Get her ready. Aelin could barely lift her head as the males heaved her up. Avriel would stay true to his word and heal her, but Fenris couldn't hold out against the Blood Oath's command. He knew the bastard would regret it, knew the wolf had been horrified the moment Elide had jumped between them. Lorcan let go of his shield, praying she wouldn't watch when the bloodletting started. When he and Fenris went claw to claw and fang to fang, he'd last against the warrior, until Gavriel joined back in. The shield vanished, and Gavriel was instantly kneeling, reaching with his broad hands for her arm. Pain paralyzed her, but she tried telling Lorcan to run, to put the shield back up. Lorcan stood, shutting out her pleading. He faced Fenris. The warrior was trembling with restraint, his hands clenched at his sides to keep from going for any of his blades. Elide was still sobbing, still begging him. Fenris's taut features were lined with regret. Lorcan just smiled at the warrior. It snapped Fenris's leash. His sentinel leaped for him, sword out, and Lorcan lifted his own, already knowing the move Fenris planned to use. He'd trained him how to do it, and he knew the guard Fenris let drop on his left side, just for a heartbeat, exposing his neck. Fenris landed before him, swiping low and dodging right. Lorcan angled his blade for that vulnerable neck. They were both blown back by an icy, unbreakable wind, whatever was left of it after the battle. Fenris was up, lost to the Blood Fury, but the wind slammed into him, again, again, holding him down. Lorcan struggled against it, but the shield Whitethorn had thrown over them, the raw power he now used to keep them pinned, was too strong when his own magic was depleted. Boots crunched on the burnt grass. Sprawled on the bank of a little hill, Lorcan lifted his head. Whitethorn stood between him and Fenris, the prince's eyes glazed with wrath. Rowan surveyed Gavriel and Elide, the latter still weeping, still begging for it to stop. But her arm? A scratch marred that moon-white arm, but Gavriel's rough battlefield healing had filled the holes, the missing flesh and broken bones. He must have used all his magic to... Gavriel swayed ever so slightly. Whitethorn's voice was like gravel.
This ends now.
You two don't touch them. They're under the protection of Aelin Galathinius. If you harm them, it will be considered an act of war. Specific ancient words. The only way a blood order could be detained. Not overridden, just delayed for a little while. To buy them all time. Fenris panted, but relief flickered in his eyes. Gavriel sagged a bit. Elide's dark eyes were still glassy with pain, the smattering of freckles on her cheeks stark against the unnatural whiteness of her skin. Whitethorn said to Fenris and Gavriel,
"Are we clear on what the hell will happen if you step out of line?"
To Lorcan's eternal shock, they lowered their heads and said,
"Yes, Prince."
Rowan let the shields drop, and then Lorcan was hurtling to Elide, who struggled to sit up, gaping at her nearly healed arm. Gavriel, wisely, backed away. Lorcan examined her arm, her face, needing to touch her, smell her. He didn't notice that the light footsteps in the grass didn't belong to his former companions, but he knew the female voice that said from behind him, the movement set her body roaring in such pain that darkness swarmed in. But she fought it, gritted her teeth, and silently roared back at that agony, that darkness. A few feet away,
Elide slid to her knees as if she'd beg until her body gave out. But Manon caught her.
We're going now,
Manon said, tugging her away. Inland.
No!
Elide spat, thrashing. Lorkin's eyes widened. But with Maeve's command, he couldn't move. Couldn't do anything as Manon slammed the hilt of Windcleaver into the side of Elide's head. The girl dropped like a stone. That was all Manon needed to haul her over a shoulder and say to Maeve, good luck. Her eyes slid to Aelin's once. Only once. Then she looked away. Maeve ignored the witch as Manon prowled toward the heart of the marshes. Lorkin's body strained. Strained, like he was fighting that blood oath with everything in him. Aelin didn't care. The males half-dragged her toward Maeve, toward the iron box, and the chains, and the iron mask. Whorls of fire, little suns, and embers had been shaped into its dark surface, a mockery of the power it was to contain. The power Maeve had needed to ensure was fully drained before she locked her up. The only way she could ever lock her up. Every inch her feet dragged through the sand was a lifetime. Every inch was a heartbeat. Blood soaked her pants. She likely wouldn't be able to heal her wounds within all that iron. Not until Maeve decided to heal them herself. But Maeve wouldn't let her die. Not with the word keys in the bath. An idealist. That's what Marion was. Someone who wanted to fight for her queen, who believed, as Nick did, that this world could be better. As they cleared the other side of the bridge, the soldiers letting them pass without fuss, as they meandered past the line on that side and emerged onto the plains themselves, Lorkin wondered at that anger, at that belief in a better world. He didn't feel like telling either Marion or Nick that their dream was a fool's one. Marion relaxed enough to peer out the back of the wagon, at the grasses flanking the wide dirt road, at the blue sky, at the roaring river and the looming sprawl of Oakwald behind them. And for all her rage, a tentative sort of wonder grew in her dark eyes. He ignored it. Lorkin had seen the worst and best in men for 500 years. There was no such thing as a better world, no such thing as a happy end, because there were no endings, and there would be nothing waiting for them in this war, nothing waiting for an escaped slave girl, but a shallow grave. Chapter 20 Rowan Whitethorn just needed a place to rest. He didn't give a shit if it was a bed, or a pile of hay, or even beneath a horse in a stable. As long as it was quiet, and there was a roof to keep out the driving veils of rain, he didn't care. Skull's Bay was what he expected, and yet not. Ramshackle buildings, painted every color but mostly in cracking disrepair, were bustling. As residents shuttered windows and hauled in clotheslines against the storm that had chased Rowan and Dorian into the harbor minutes ago. Hooded and cloaked, no one had asked them any questions once Rowan had held sway over the few surviving lords, mostly through his years of carefully handling Otterlin during the occupation. She gave him a glare sharp enough to slice skin. Adian lifted his hands.
Can you blame me for wanting to make sure this goes smoothly?
She shrugged, but didn't bite his head off. Darrow was your uncle's lover, he added, stretching his legs out before him.
For decades. He's never spoken once to me about your uncle, but they were very close, Aelin. Darrow didn't publicly mourn Orlan beyond what was required after the passing of a king. But he became a different man afterward. He's a hard bastard now, but still a fair one. Much of what he's done has been out of his unfading love for Orlan, and for Terrison. His own maneuvering kept us from becoming completely starved and destitute. Remember that—
What the rutting hell is going on?
Elide had no words to express to Lorcan what she'd felt. In that moment, he let the shield drop. What she'd felt when the silver-haired, tattooed warrior prince had halted that fatal bloodshed. But she had no breath in her body when she looked over Lorcan's broad shoulder and beheld the golden-haired woman striding toward them.
Be he. The peoples of the ancient worlds who never sinned, for whom he never came down, are the peoples for whose sake the low worlds were made. For though the healing what was wounded and the straightening what was bent is a new dimension of glory, yet the straight was not made that it might be bent, nor the whole that it might be wounded. The ancient peoples are at the center, blessed be he. All which is not itself, the great dance was made in order that he might come down into it. In the fallen world he prepared for himself a body, and was united with the dust, and made it glorious for ever. This is the end and final cause of all creating, and the sin whereby it came is called fortunate, and the world where this was enacted is the center of worlds, blessed be he. The tree was planted in that world, but the fruit has ripened in this. The fountain that sprang with mingled blood and life in the dark world flows here with life only. We have passed the first cataracts, and from here onward the stream flows deep and turns in the direction of the sea. This is the morning star which he promised to those who conquer. This is the center of worlds. Till now all has waited, but now the trumpet has sounded and the army is on the move. Blessed be he. Though men or angels rule them, the worlds are for themselves. The waters you have not floated on, the fruit you have not plucked, the caves into which you have not descended, and the fire through which your bodies cannot pass, do not await your coming to put on perfection, though they will obey you when you come. Times without number I have circled Arbol while you were not alive, and those times were not desert. Their own voice was in them, not merely a dreaming of the day when you should awake. They also were at the center. Be comforted, small immortals. You are not the voice that all things utter, nor is there eternal silence in the places where you cannot come. No feet have walked, nor shall, on the ice of Glund. No eye looked up from beneath on the ring of Lurga, and Iron Plain in Nerroval is chaste and empty. Yet it is not for nothing that the gods walk ceaselessly around the fields of Arbol, blessed be he. That dust itself which is scattered so rare in heaven, whereof all worlds and the bodies that are not worlds are made, is at the center. It waits not till created eyes have seen it or hands handled it, to be in itself a strength and splendor of Maleldil. Only the least part has served or ever shall a beast, a man, or a god. But always and beyond all distances, before they came and after they are gone, and where they never come, it is what is, and utters the heart of the Holy One with its own voice. It is farthest from him of all things, for it has no life, nor sense, nor reason. It is nearest to him of all things, for without intervening soul, as sparks fly out of fire, he utters in each grain of it the unmixed image of his energy. Each grain, if it spoke, would say, I am at the center. For me all things were made. Let no mouth open to gainsay it. Blessed be he. Each grain is at the center. The dust is at the center. The worlds are at the center. The beasts are at the center. The ancient peoples are there. The race that sinned is there. Tor and Tinidril are there. The gods are there also. Blessed be he. Where Maleldil is, there is the center. He is in every place, not some of him in one place and some in another, but in each place the whole Maleldil, even in the smallness beyond thought. There is no way out of the center save into the bent will, which casts itself into the nowhere, blessed be he. Each thing was made for him, he is the center. Because we are with him, each of us is at the center. It is not as in a city of the darkened world, where they say that each must live for all. In his city all things are made for each. When he died in the wounded world, he died not for men, but for each man. If each man had been the only man made, he would have done no less. Each thing, from the single grain of dust to the strongest Eldil, is the end and the final cause of all creation, and the mirror in which the beam of his brightness comes to rest, and so returns to him, blessed be he. In the plan of the great dance, plans without number interlock, and each movement becomes in its season the breaking into flower of the whole design to which all else had been directed. Thus each is equally at the center, and none are thereby being equals, but some by giving place and some by receiving it, the small things by their smallness and the great by their greatness, and all the patterns linked and looped together by the unions of a kneeling with a sceptered love. Blessed be he. He has immeasurable use for each thing that is made, that his love and splendor may flow forth like a strong river which has need of a great watercourse, and fills alike the deep pools and the little crannies, that are filled equally and remain unequal. And when it has filled them brimful, it flows over and makes new channels. We also have need beyond measure of all that he has made. Love me, my brothers, for I am infinitely necessary to you, and for your delight I was made. Blessed be he. He has no need at all of anything that is made. An Eldil is not more needful to him than a grain of the dust. A peopled world no more needful than a world that is empty, but all needless alike, and what all add to him is nothing. We also have no need of anything that is made. Love me, my brothers, for I am infinitely superfluous, and your love shall be like his, born neither of your need nor of my deserving, but a plain bounty. Blessed be he. All things are by him and for him. He utters himself also for his own delight, and sees that he is good. He is his own begotten, and what proceeds from him is himself. Blessed be he. All that is made seems planless to the darkened mind, because there are more plans than it looked for. In these seas there are islands where the hairs of the turf are so fine and so closely woven together that unless a man looked long at them he would see neither hairs nor weaving at all, but only the same and the flat. So with the great dance. Set your eyes on one movement, and it will lead you through all patterns, and it will seem to you the master movement. But the seeming will be true. Let no mouth open to gainsay it. There seems no plan, because it is all plan. There seems no center, because it is all center. Blessed be he. Yet this seeming also is the end and final cause for which he spreads out time so long and heaven so deep. Lest if we never met the dark, and the road that leads nowhither, and the question to which no answer is imaginable, we should have in our minds no likeness of the abyss of the Father, into which, if a creature drop down his thoughts for ever, he shall hear no echo return to him. Blessed, blessed, blessed be he. And now, by a transition which he did not notice, it seemed that what had begun as speech was turned into sight, or into something that can be remembered only as if it were seeing. He thought he saw the great dance. It seemed to be woven out of the intertwining undulation of many cords or bands of light, leaping over and under one another, and mutually embraced in arabesques and flower-like subtleties. Each figure, as he looked at it, became the master figure or focus of the whole spectacle, by means of which his eye disentangled all else and brought it into unity, only to be itself entangled when he looked to what he had taken for mere marginal decorations, and found that there also the same hegemony was claimed, and the claim made good, yet the former pattern not thereby dispossessed, but finding in its new subordination a significance greater than that which it had abdicated. He could see also, but the word seeing is now plainly inadequate, wherever the ribbons or serpents of light intersected, minute corpuscles of momentary brightness. And he knew somehow that these particles were the secular generalities of which history tells, peoples, institutions, climates of opinion, civilizations, arts, sciences, and the like, ephemeral coruscations that piped their short song and vanished. The ribbons or cords themselves, in which millions of corpuscles lived and died, were things of some different kind. At first he could not say what, but he knew in the end that most of them were individual entities. If so, the time in which the great dance proceeds is very unlike time as we know it. Some of the thinner and more delicate cords were beings that we call short-lived, flowers and insects, a fruit or a storm of rain, and once, he thought, a wave of the sea. Others were such things as we also think lasting, crystals, rivers, mountains, or even stars. Far above these in girth and luminosity and flashing with colours from beyond our spectrum were the lines of the personal beings, and yet as different from one another in splendour as all of them from all the previous class. But not all the cords were individuals. Some were universal truths or universal qualities. It did not surprise him then to find that these and the persons were both chords and both stood together as against the mere atoms of generality which lived and died in the clashing of their streams. But afterwards, when he came back to earth, he wondered. And by now the thing must have passed altogether out of the region of sight as we understand it. For he says that the whole solid figure of these enamoured and inter-inanimated circlings was suddenly revealed as the mere superficies of a far vaster pattern in four dimensions, and that figure as the boundary of yet others in other worlds. Till suddenly, as the movement grew yet swifter, the interweaving yet more ecstatic, the relevance of all to all yet more intense, as dimension was added to dimension, and that part of him which could reason and remember was dropped farther and farther behind that part of him which saw, even then, at the very zenith of complexity, complexity was eaten up and faded, as a thin white cloud fades into the hard blue burning of the sky, and a simplicity beyond all comprehension, ancient and young as spring, illimitable, pellucid, drew him with chords of infinite desire into its own stillness. He went up into such a quietness, a privacy, and a freshness, that at the very moment when he stood farthest from our ordinary mode of being, he had the sense of stripping off encumbrances, and awaking from trance, and coming to himself. With a gesture of relaxation he looked about him. The animals had gone. The two white figures had disappeared, Tor and Tinidril and he were alone, in ordinary Perelandrian daylight, early in the morning. "Where are the beasts?" said Ransom. "They have gone about their small affairs," said Tinidril. "They have gone to bring up their whelps and lay their eggs, to build their nests and spin their webs and dig their burrows, to sing and play and to eat and drink." "They did not wait long," said Ransom, "for I feel it is still early in the morning." "But not the same morning," said Tor. "We have been here long, then?" asked Ransom. "Yes," said Tor. "I did not know it till now, but we have accomplished one whole circle about Arbol since we met on this mountain top." "A year?" said Ransom. "A whole year? Oh, heavens, what may by now have happened in my own dark world? Did you know, Father, that so much time was passing?" "I did not feel it pass," said Tor. "I believe the waves of time will often change for us henceforward. We are coming to have it in our own choice whether we shall be above them and see many waves together, or whether we shall reach them one by one as we used to." "It comes into my mind," said Tinidril, "that today, now that the year has brought us back to the same place in heaven, the Eldila are coming for Pybald to take him back to his own world." "You are right, Tinidril," said Tor. Then he looked at Ransom and said, "There is a red dew coming up out of your foot, like a little spring." Ransom looked down and saw that his heel was still bleeding. "Yes," he said, "it is where the evil one bit me. The redness is of Hru, blood." "Sit down, friend," said Tor, "and let me wash your foot in this pool." Ransom hesitated, but the king compelled him. So presently he sat on the little bank, and the king kneeled before him in the shallow water and took the injured foot in his hand. He paused as he looked at it. "So this is Hru," he said at last. "I have never seen such a fluid before. And this is the substance wherewith Maleldil remade the worlds before any world was made." He washed the foot for a long time, but the bleeding did not stop. "Does it mean that Pybald will die?" said Tinidril at last. "I do not think so," said Tor. "I think that any of his race who has breathed the air that he has breathed, and drunk the waters that he has drunk since he came to the Holy Mountain, will not find it easy to die. Tell me, friend, was it not so in your world that after they had lost their paradise, the men of your race did not learn to die quickly?" "I had heard," said Ransom, "that those first generations were long livers, but most take it for only a story or a poetry, and I had not thought of the cause." "Oh," said Tinidril suddenly, "the Eldila are coming to take him." Ransom looked round and saw not the white man-like forms in which he had last seen Mars and Venus, but only the almost invisible lights. The king and queen apparently recognized the spirits in this guise also. As easily, he thought, as an earthly king would recognize his acquaintances even when they were not in court dress. The king released Ransom's foot,
and all three of them went towards the white casket. Its covering lay beside it on the ground. All felt an impulse to delay. "What is this that we feel, Tor?" said Tenedril. "I don't know," said the king. "One day I will give it a name. This is not a day for making names." "It is like a fruit with a very thick shell," said Tenedril. "The joy of our meeting when we meet again in the great dance is the sweet of it. But the rind is thick, more years thick than I can count." "You see now," said Tor, "what that evil one would have done to us. If we had listened to him, we should now be trying to get at that sweet without biting through the shell." "And so it would not be that sweet at all," said Tenedril. "It is now his time to go," said the tingling voice of an Eldil. Ransom found no words to say as he laid himself down in the casket. The sides rose up high above him like walls. Beyond them, as if framed in a coffin-shaped window, he saw the golden sky and the faces of Tor and Tenedril. "You must cover my eyes," he said presently, and the two human forms went out of sight for a moment and returned. Their arms were full of rose-red lilies. Both bent down and kissed him. He saw the king's hand lifted in blessing, and then never saw anything again in that world. They covered his face with the cool petals till he was blinded in a red, sweet-smelling cloud. "Is all ready?" said the king's voice. "Farewell, friend and saviour, farewell," said both voices. "Farewell till we three pass out of the dimensions of time. Speak of us always to Maleldil as we speak always of you. The splendour, the love, and the strength be upon you." Then came the great cumbrous noise of the lid being fastened on above him. Then, for a few seconds, noises without in the world from which he was eternally divided. Then his consciousness was engulfed. This concludes the reading of Perelandra by C.S. Lewis. Copyright 1944 by Clive Staples Lewis. This unabridged recording of the reading of Perelandra was published by arrangement with the C.S. Lewis Company and was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audio Books Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Books. This book was read by Jeffrey Howard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.